Was bedeutet Erinnerung? Was bedeutet es, den Unbekannten eine Geschichte zu geben? Was bedeutet es, Geschichte mit Menschlichkeit zu erzählen? Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen. Dem Podcast vom Volksbund Deutscher Kriegsgräberfürsorge e.V., Landesverband Berlin. Ich bin Holly Perchel, Praktikantin beim Volksbund und Studentin an der Universität Leeds in Großbritannien. Ich leite das Forschungsprojekt Unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen. Das Ziel des Projekts ist es, biografische Informationen über die Gefallenen aus dem Commonwealth herauszufinden, sodass die Gefallenen, egal ob Soldat oder Zivilist, als Menschen anstatt als reine Statistik erinnert werden. In jeder Folge des Podcasts werde ich die Geschichte von Gefallenen erzählen, die in der ehemaligen britischen Besatzungszone Berlins gegraben wurden. Es ist meine Absicht, dass ihre Geschichten mit Menschlichkeit, Respekt und Mitgefühl dargestellt werden. Für jede erzählte Geschichte werde ich den Friedhof der Gefallenen, den Berlin War Cemetery in der Heerstraße, besuchen und ihnen eine weiße Rose niederlegen. Diese weißen Rosen symbolisieren nicht nur Erinnerung und Dankbarkeit, sondern auch Menschlichkeit. Die meisten der Biografien sind sicherlich Fliege gewesen. Die Bombardierung von Städten wurde von den Kriegsparteien beider Seiten als Kampfmittel gegen die Zivilbevölkerung eingesetzt. Obwohl ich mich in diesem Podcast vor allem mit Berlin beschäftige, waren natürlich nicht nur deutsche Städte von Bombardierungen betroffen. Im Jahr 1939 findet die ersten Angriffe statt. Die deutsche Luftwaffe flog auf die Städte Warschau und Rotterdam. Ab Mai 1940 flog die britische Luftwaffe die ersten Angriffe auf deutsche Städte. Am 14. November 1940 flog die deutsche Luftwaffe unter dem Decknamen Unternehmen Mondscheinsonate einen schweren Bombenangriff auf Coventry, Mitte Englands. Am 3. Februar 1945 findet eine der heftigsten Bombardierungen Berlins statt. Von 1958 Maschinen der United States Army Air Forces kamen 939 durch die deutschen Verteidigungslinien. Wir sprechen hier von schweren Bomben mit 10 bis 12 Mann Besatzung. Wenn man mal hochrechnet, wie viele Menschen in der Luft waren, 9.580 bis ungefähr 11.500. Die albtraumatischen Bilder aus dem Krieg in der Ukraine lassen uns einen das Schicksal dieser Menschen noch mehr erahnen. Und es wirkt auf einmal alles viel realer, obwohl es schon fast 80 Jahre her ist. Mit 78 Jahren ist der Zweite Weltkrieg bald fast 3 Generationen vorbei. 78 Jahre, eigentlich die Zeitspanne eines Lebens. Was hätten diese Menschen von einem Leben zu erzählen gehabt? Und hier kommen wir wieder zu dem Thema, können wir gemeinsam erinnern? Oder wie ist es möglich, gemeinsam zu erinnern, in Freundschaft? Welche Rolle spielt das Politische und das Persönliche in der Erinnerungskultur? Ist kollektive Erinnerung möglich, wenn unsere nationalen Narrativen so unterschiedlich sind? Mein ganzes Leben lang habe ich mich für deutsche-britische Beziehungen im Lauf der Geschichte interessiert. Seit meiner Schulzeit hat mich das Vorurteil über die deutsche Sprache in Großbritannien sogar in unserem Bildungssystem fasziniert. Wieso ist es, dass Deutsch immer noch als aggressiv in britischen Medien dargestellt wird? Ich werde sehr häufig gefragt, wieso ich Deutsch gelernt habe. Solche Fragen bekommen Französisch- und Spanisch-StudentInnen nicht. Ich finde es schade, dass in Großbritannien dieses Vorurteil immer noch so sichtbar in unserer Gesellschaft ist. Besonders wenn Großbritannien viel von Deutschland im Bereich der Erinnerungskultur lernen könnte. Wir haben selbst Schuld und trotz der Entwicklung vom Postkolonialismus und solchen Bewegungen wie Why is my curriculum white und Black Lives Matter ist die Rolle des Kolonialismus in unserer Geschichte ein sehr umstrittenes Thema. Wir haben selbst noch viel zu tun, um unsere Vergangenheit zu bewältigen. Man bekommt den Eindruck, dass Verurteile gegen andere Länder oft als praktische Ausrede genommen wird, um uns mit unserer eigenen Geschichte in Großbritannien, mit unserer eigenen Schuld nicht zu konfrontieren. Seit dem Brexit mache ich mir viele Sorgen über mein eigenes Land. Wir haben so lange in Großbritannien eine kulturelle Amnesie, in der die Geschichte immer noch sehr selektiv erzählt wird. Meiner Meinung nach war der Brexit eine Bestätigung dieser Amnesie, einen Angriff gegen eine transkulturelle Erinnerungskultur. Mit diesem Projekt möchte ich die Erinnerungskulturen von Großbritannien und Deutschland zusammenbringen. Laut meiner Auffassung ist Frieden eine Frage der Zusammenarbeit. Kollektiv zu erkennen bedeutet, Grenzen zu bewältigen, Menschen zusammenzubringen, um gegen Hass und Verurteil zu kämpfen. Dabei hilft, miteinander zu reden, aufeinander zuzugehen, sich kennenzulernen, abseits der Politik und Nachrichten und die jeweiligen Geschichten zu kennen. Daher möchte ich Sie auch mitnehmen, um die vielleicht Ihnen unbekannten Geschichte zu erzählen. In jeder Folge des Podcasts hören Sie zwei Geschichten der Gefallenen aus dem Commonwealth und zwei Interviews mit ExpertInnen im Bereich der Erinnerungskultur. Im ersten Teil des Podcasts hören Sie die Geschichte von Ernest Crandall und ein Interview mit dem Forscher Richie Conahan. Im zweiten Teil hören Sie die Geschichte vom Sergeant Ralph Henderson und ein Interview mit dem Forscher Bill Dorton. In dieser Folge beschäftigen wir uns mit der Frage der Sichtbarkeit. Warum ist es wichtig, den Unbekannten eine Geschichte zu geben? Und wie können die Geschichte von Gefallenen erzählt werden, die nie gefunden wurden? Heute möchte ich eine sehr komplizierte Geschichte erzählen. Sie beginnt mit einem Tagebuch und einem Namen. In diese Geschichte geht um Ernest Crandall, der zum 4. Bataillon des Cheshire Regiment gehörte. Crandalls Name steht auf dem Dunkirk-Denkmal, aber niemand weiß, wo genau er gegraben wurde. Aber wer genau war Ernest Crandall? Und wieso kann es sein, dass seine Geschichte so viele Lücken hat? Es freut mich sehr, dass wir heute ein Interview mit Richie Conahan haben, der über Ernest Crandall mit großer Entschlossenheit forschte. Zusammen mit seiner Frau Lorna Conahan hat Richie das Girvan Great War Project gegründet. Richie und Lorna forschten im Laufe des Projekts ungefähr 600 Soldaten aus ihrer lokalen Gemeinschaft, die im Ersten und Zweiten Weltkrieg ums Leben kamen. Sie entdeckten die Identitäten von hunderten Unbekannten und schenkten den Angehörigen der Soldaten die Wahrheit über das Schicksal ihres Angehörigen. Das folgende Interview wird auf Englisch durchgeführt. Der Text des Interviews auf Deutsch und auf Englisch stehen Ihnen im Anhang zur Verfügung. Okay, so would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Richie Conahan and I run the Girvan and District Great War Project.
Okay, so my first question is concerning one of the main people that you've been researching recently, which is Ernest Grendel. So who was Ernest Grendel and how did you come across him?
Several years ago, we were given 7 pages of an old-fashioned type diary, and it was cataloguing from January 1945 until May 1945. And in amongst this diary was there was very few names mentioned, and the only one mentioned in full was Ernest Grendel. So that's how we came across him. Didn't know anything about his story. It wasn't sort of locally connected to the area, and it was just pure curiosity that took me on this journey.
Yeah, and so you've talked about this really admirable curiosity about Ernest Grendel when you don't have any personal connection to him and your family. Where do you think this passion has come from? Do you think it's from the diary or elsewhere?
I think it's probably over the years we've researched hundreds and hundreds of local guys. And I think because it wasn't a local, it was just maybe something a wee bit different, but because he was the only man mentioned in the diary, it was just pure nosiness to see, well, okay, so what is his story, because he's the only one mentioned in the diary. So that took me on this kind of route of, let's see if we can find out more about him and find out who he was and where he was from.
Yeah, and why are you so determined to put a name to Grendel's grave? Why do you think that that's so important?
I think putting a name to something, it's, we like to kind of label it as giving the past a future, because it could be one of these things that could just, we could never have got that diary and we couldn't have went down the road that we've been on, and nobody would have known what this story of this man would be.
Yeah, and I think that it's really important how you talk about how the past is so intimately connected with the future, and how sort of through working through the past we can understand where we've come, how we've come to where we are today.
Yeah.
So a diary is obviously a really personal document. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think these personal documents that are perhaps more human than a history textbook or, you know, official military reports are so important in telling stories of people who lost their lives during the war?
I think when it comes to diaries, you've got that personal, there's that personal connection. I think that when it comes to military reports, they're focusing on the details of what they were doing or the actions that they were involved on. But when it comes to the likes of this kind of diary, it's how much food the guys getting, or how much food the guys weren't getting, the conditions that they were sort of having to endure in these different barns and the different places, and the distances that we're covering, and I think it makes it more real rather than it's just a bog standard text of, well, so and so did this on so and so a day, and I think it varies. It differs from like a war diary that's written by an adjutant somewhere. This is written by the guys that are experiencing it firsthand, and it's their recollections and their reflections on what they're going through at the time.
Yeah, and so we've spoken a little bit about the importance of the diary, and that was sort of the starting point for your research. How did you go about finding more about Grendon?
Well, the thing is, we still don't know who this hand type diary was from. It just details what they'd done, and when the guy was released, and he travelled from London up to Edinburgh, travelled from Edinburgh through to Glasgow, and then get the tram home. At no point does he mention what regiment he's in or anything else. And I think because of that, it's like, if we find in this Grendel story, can we find out who this guy was? So there was that element to it as well. But I think ultimately for me, because he was the only one that was mentioned by his full name in the diary, that curiosity had to take me somewhere, and that's just, it's kind of how we do things. It's building that story. They're not just a name on a memorial or a name on a headstone. Every single person has their own story to tell. So for me, the diary was critical that, although it was only a short period of time, it was only covering 5 months, I knew that there was obviously more to that story than met the eye, because that curiosity led me to look up on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, where have they got Ernest Grendel? And they had him on the Dunkirk Memorial, when I know that the diary relates to the fact that it states that he was buried in a small churchyard in Marass near Mecklenburg. So that was where that journey was taking me, and it was saying, well, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission don't know where he's buried. So that took us then to submitting that diary to ask, is this of information of any interest to you guys?
Yeah, and I think it's really important that you talk about how important it is to humanise these stories and remember that, you know, these soldiers weren't just statistics, they're not just sort of results of a conflict or anything like that. They have their own memories and families. And we've spoken a little bit about how important it is to humanise history. And I think that it's also important to acknowledge the role of the researcher as well. And I found that it's throughout this project, it's a bit of a grieving process when you find these documents, that you feel as if you've read these documents and you've almost got this person's voice in your head. And then it comes to a certain point and the letters are gone. There's no more sort of correspondence from them. And you think, where has this person gone that I've got to know, I feel I've got to know in some capacity? And I was just wondering how you found the research process when looking into Grendel's life.
At first it was, there was that element of, right, the authorities don't know the information that's in this diary. So that was the kind of first bit into it. And then it was like, let's look and see what else we can find. So when we got the newspaper report that had his photograph on it, it's very, very sobering, Ken, because it's got Alyssa's mum and dad and where they're staying. But ultimately, it had suggested that he had actually been taken a prisoner of war at Dunkirk. So he's endured 5 years in these camps and he's on his way home and he dies, and you think, well, how more human can you get than that? I mean, they would have had no idea what was happening in the wider world, what was happening in the Far East, or what was happening in Africa. They would have had no clue. And I think, for me, it's, there might not be any family left to pass that story on to, or to get information from. But on the other hand, there might be, and they have no idea where he is. They might still think he's lost in Dunkirk somewhere and have no idea that he's been on this incredible, painful journey.
Mm. And we spoke a little bit about contact with the fallen's family, and if it's actually possible to get contact with them, because sometimes a lot of families are relayed false information about their family members, not necessarily intentionally, but sometimes that is the case. So I was just wondering, what makes your research so worthwhile, and do you have any stories about where you really realised this project's really important to me?
Yeah, well, we have always been asked, from initially contacting the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, we've always been asked, don't try and contact any family. So until this whole process takes place, that story is between us and the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and at some point we hope that we'll be able to say to somebody, there is your uncle or there is your great uncle's story of the war that they didn't know of, and I think that's important, not only from my point of research, and that the feeling that we get when we pass that information on other cases that we've worked on. If you could bottle that, you'd be worth millions. Okay? And I think that's where we've had cases in the past of men from the First World War who were not recognised by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and they've been fully validated now. And I remember telling somebody, your great great uncle is now commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. His name is now on the Scottish National Roll of Honour at Edinburgh Castle. And to me, that's just the best feeling in the world, and it proves the worth of what we're doing, and it just makes it worthwhile, and it makes you kind of strive to find out more about other people that you don't know the story of, so that you can pass that on to the families. And as I say, it's almost that person's story for you to pass on to future generations. So that's again, back to giving the past a future, because if nobody does that for any of these guys, these stories will all be lost forever. Because there's an old African proverb that we tend to use when we're speaking to people, and that's, when someone dies, a library burns down. So it's important to speak to the elder members of your family and get the stories that you can while they're still here to tell them. And I know that sometimes it can be difficult for family to talk about that, or that it's maybe just one of these things that are shut away. Even if you can get them to write it and leave it in their will or whatever else, so that information is there at some point.
Yeah, and I think it's really amazing, and something that you acknowledge when you're doing archival work or any kind of research in this capacity, that, you know, one dog-eared page can contain an entire life, an entire story, and that could be the only remains of someone that had one of these amazing adventures and a really tragic story like that of Grendel. And so we've talked a little bit about all these little puzzle pieces and how we put them together in order to make a story. And one of the people that you mentioned in our previous discussions was James Fulton. So who was James Fulton, and why is he important to this story in particular?
Well, James Fulton was, Ernest was in Camp 20B, and James Fulton was the camp man of confidence. So he had kept a diary from the day that they were captured in Dunkirk till the day they were released. So he had every single detail. He was the go-between between the prisoners and the camp commandants and things like that. So if they were needing extra stuff, it was down to James to go and ask for it. In his diary, the very, very first page in July 1941, his first entry is, took over as camp man of confidence. So he's had that confidence to say, right, I'm going to be in charge here, this is what we're going to do. So he detailed every single thing for the whole time that they were in the camps. So his writings, his diary, were critical to this, because initially when I had sent the information from the type diary, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission came back and said, we need more evidence to prove that this is Ernest Grendel. However, we can tell you that after the war, one body was recovered from Marass churchyard and is now interred in an unknown grave in Berlin, the 1945 cemetery, which takes us to where we are just now. But in Fulton's diary, because he detailed everything so diligently, I could then look through that for the information, and the information of Ernest's burial was in there. So I could then go either 6 weeks either side of that and list everybody that Fulton had listed as dying and being buried, and cross-reference that with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, what compared to what the diary had. And it was that finding where the diary said he was buried compared to where the Commonwealth War Graves said he was buried, and tying in with the grave registration and if there was an exhumation report. So I had 12 men that I was researching. So I've managed to tick off 11 of them, and everything ties in with where they should be. The only one that I don't have any confirmation on is Ernest Grendel. But the information in Fulton's diary, the information in the type diary, would suggest to me that it leads it to the unknown grave in Berlin. So Fulton's diary was absolutely critical to that. The original diary is kept at Fort George near Inverness. But James Fulton's grandson is a doctor in Chicago, and he kindly sent me a digital copy of the whole diary. So it's got every piece of detail that you could possibly want and need. And that, the human aspect of that is just, it's incredible.
Yeah, and we've spoken a little bit about how important it is to keep these stories alive, because obviously in my generation it's becoming more and more difficult to have these personal testimonies, because the people that, you know, were of the war generation just simply won't be there for that many generations longer. So what are your plans to keep the story of Ernest Grendel alive? How do you plan to maintain his memory?
Well, even if, for whatever reason, he's not commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves in Berlin, he's still one of the guys that we've researched, and we'll keep plugging away, we'll keep putting on posts. For a few years now, the diary that we have, we've put on the information for that on the corresponding date, so that in the hope that if someone somewhere from his family does a Google search for his name, it comes up and we can tell what story we found. It might not be the ideal situation where we can say to them, oh, by the way, if you want to go and visit, he's buried at Berlin. That's a decision that's out with my reach. But he's one of our boys now. He's one of our boys, and we always do, and we always will remember him. And we've got 640 adopted kids, if you want to put it that kind of way. So we've got quite a big family.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That was such a beautiful end to the interview. I think that the work that you've done is so amazing and such an inspiration to this project, that you start off with this tiny seed and it grows into this entire forest, if you like, of all these different stories, and every little branch has a different memory. And it's so important to be doing research like this, and I'm really grateful that you've done this research and that you've given this interview, and that we get to put another candle, if you like, out for Ernest Grendel and make sure that we light the way for future projects such as this. So thank you so much for your time.
No problem.
Ich wählte diese Geschichte, weil sie demonstriert, wie man mit einer Geschichte Hoffnung schenken kann. Den Unbekannten eine Geschichte zu geben, bedeutet nicht nur Sichtbarkeit für die Gefallenen, sondern auch Trost für ihre Familien, die jahrzehntelang darauf warteten, die wahre Geschichte von ihren Angehörigen zu erfahren. Mir ist auch wichtig, dass diese Geschichte die Herausforderung und Spannung der Archivarbeit demonstriert. Wie so viele Geschichten aus der Kriegszeit beginnt Krendels Geschichte mit einer Ego-Quelle, das Tagebuch, die ihm nur einen Namen schenkt. Aber dadurch schaffte Ritchie, die Puzzleteilchen von Krendels Leben zusammenzubringen. Durch mein Interview mit Ritchie entdeckte ich die Rolle von Geduld und Hoffnung in der Suche nach den Gefallenen. Grendels Geschichte beginnt mit einem Tagebuch. Er war nur ein paar Buchstaben. Ritchie hat ihm eine Identität zurückgegeben. Im zweiten Teil des Podcasts beschäftigen wir uns mit dem Unterschied zwischen persönlicher Erinnerung und kultureller oder kollektiver Erinnerung. Sind sie beide verbunden oder kann man sie einfach nicht zusammenbringen? Welche Rolle spielt das Persönliche im nationalen Narrativ über einen Konflikt in einem Land? Können persönliche Erinnerung und kollektive Erinnerung in Konflikt kommen? Um dieses Thema genau zu untersuchen, haben wir heute einen sehr besonderen Gast, der die Geschichte von seinem Großonkel erzählen möchte. Bill Dawsons Großonkel war Pilot Officer Ralph Henderson, der im Zweiten Weltkrieg wie so viele andere ums Leben kam. Trotz der Kürze seiner Karriere leistete Henderson sehr viel. Als sein Lancaster-Bomber am 12. März 1943 abstürzte, konnte Henderson sich mit seinem Fallschirm in Sicherheit bringen, während viele Männer aus seiner Staffel ums Leben kamen. Henderson schaffte es, nicht ins Kriegsgefangenschaft zu geraten und verdiente dabei den Distinguished Flying Medal vom König für seinen Mut. Aber ein paar Monate später, nachdem er seine Frau Muriel heiratete, wurde sein Bomber am 22. November 1943 über Berlin abgeschossen. Ein Jahr lang war das Schicksal von Henderson nicht bekannt, bis Muriel endlich im Jahr 1944 über den Absturz des Bombers per Telegramm erfuhr. Heute erfahren wir mehr über Pilot Ralph Henderson durch seinen Großneffen Bill Dawson. Das folgende Interview wird auf Englisch durchgeführt. Der Text des Interviews auf Deutsch und Englisch stehen Ihnen im Anhang zur Verfügung. Thank you so much for your time. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
No, pleasure. Nice to meet you in face-to-face, virtually.
Yes. So would you like to briefly introduce yourself?
Of course. So, hi Holly. My name is Bill Dawson, and my great-uncle, Ralph Henderson, was a Lancaster bomber pilot in the Second World War. And I started quite late, I suppose, learning that I had this amazing relative by doing other family tree research. Because I'm a veteran of the Royal Navy, I've always had a particular connection to my ancestors who served in the military. I think because it gives that quite personal connection. You sort of understand a bit more what they were doing and their motivations and the lives they led. And ever since I clocked onto what he was doing, I've just been steadily following threads and putting his life together.
That's really lovely. Thank you so much for your time today. We're so pleased to have you here. So my first question is just about who Pilot Officer Ralph Henderson was and what his life was like before he joined the forces, if you know anything about his earlier life.
So Ralph was a Geordie lad from Northumberland, and no connection to the military at all, like I suppose many of his generation. And he was born in 1910. And his father had worked in the shipyards, and they moved to a little town called Blyth, which is a little port on the Northumberland coast. And Ralph went to school and played in the streets like any other little boy. And amazingly, when he was 16 years old, and I have no idea why, he up sticks and went to Australia. Which, you know, I still now find quite extraordinary what drives a 16-year-old lad from Northumberland with no connection to, as it turned out, farming, which was what he was going to do, leaves his four or five brothers and parents and goes to the other side of the world. It was just incredible. But the government were doing a scheme called the Big Brother Scheme, which was partnering with Australia, where they were sponsoring young men like Ralph to go out and get involved in farming, just to bolster the farming industry out there, I think. And it's the whole Big Brother scheme is another one of those areas that I know about it, but I don't know much about it. So it's another one of those separate research projects as part of the story. Anyway, so Ralph went to Australia. And he spent a year or two doing farming type stuff and clearly thought, yeah, that's fine, but I can do better than this. So he got into teaching. And he trained in Australia as a teacher. And then he ended up as a head teacher. And he can only have been in his early 20s at this stage. And we've got a couple of photos kicking around of him standing with a class out in the outback somewhere, with him looking terribly smart in his British suit and tie and these ragtag farm kids. Trying to be interested. Anyway, so moves on story. 1938. Ralph comes back to the UK, perhaps as a forerunner of the war breaking out. But he re-enrolls back into teacher training at a college called Cullum College in Oxford, and completes more formal British recognised teacher training. And he was doing woodwork and handicrafts and sport, which were clearly his fortes. And again, he just did really well. And we've got a copy of the final report that the head of the college wrote, which said, Ralph is one of the most promising teachers we've ever had the pleasure to come through our college, which is fantastic. And we think that's probably where he met Muriel, who was to become his wife a couple of years later. But we don't know quite how, because she was a little bit older and we think she was probably already a teacher. So it's possible that he'd gone to do teaching practice in one of the local Oxford schools and she was his mentor.
Wow. Oh, that's such an amazing story. Even before he's entering the forces, he seems to be a jack of all trades and doing all sorts of things. Wow.
Amazing things. And one of the things, I think probably as a project for his teacher training, he built an oak sort of desk bureau piece of furniture, which I now have.
Oh, wow.
It stayed with Muriel, his wife, until she died, and then went to my father's sister because they'd been quite close. And then after that, and then my dad said, you probably ought to have this.
Yeah.
So I've got it now. And it's a real treasured, tangible, physical link to Ralph and his ability back in the 1930s.
Yeah, and I think that we've spoken about this a little bit previously, how these objects and stuff contain so much life, and it's so beautiful to be able to look back when you've only got these sort of scraps or little puzzle pieces of someone's story and be able to touch them, put them together, sort of piece together a story. So that got
Yes.
me wondering, when you were talking, you've spoken a little bit about your own military background, but any other reasons that inspired you to pursue Ralph's story?
I think it's seeing our veterans through a light where they are beacons and libraries and archives of modern social history. And the more you start to look into an individual's life, and then you start looking at the aspects, so the Big Brother scheme in Australia, no idea about any of that. So you start to go, oh gosh, that's really interesting. I had no idea that was going on. And then there was, you look at teacher training, and then you find out that a little bit later on, of course, he's going up and down the country to relatives, and that must have been the train network, because they didn't really have, cars that were going to be going the length of the country the whole time. And then the sports they were playing, and you see snippets and letters, played tennis with George, and then went to see Granny Mary, and, they're just such... In the great scheme of things, they're just day-to-day trivias of everyday life. But when you start to put them together in context, then you build a 3D image of the people, but also life in 1938, 1939, 1940. And of course, as time goes on, the restrictions that war brings for people. And my aunt had written that she knew Muriel after they first got married. She was sort of dodging the blackout and going on trains to get across to where he was based, just so they could have a day together. Mm. So, yeah, it's the simplest way, I think, is keeping the story alive. But for me, it's learning about what has shaped us to be the way we are today, I think is incredibly important. And also, I didn't do history at school. I think I gave it up because it was all about learning the dates of Tudor kings and queens. And it was like, yeah, so what? not important. Why are we not teaching our children what their grandparents were doing during the war and then everything that's attached to it? Because it tells you who you are.
Yeah, I think that's something that is often forgotten in education, like you say. I mean, I've studied history for quite a while now, through from GCSE to pretty much uni now, is that it is it's so linked to your identity. And I think that when you realise how much of the past has shaped where we are today, it's really addictive looking at sort of the links. And I think it's really interesting when you particularly look at your family history, and it's completely insane how much people achieved and how much they did in such a brief period of time. Especially a lot of these soldiers, specifically when we're talking about the military, they were only, a couple years older than me, some younger than me. I'm 20, and they achieved so much, and they became such well-rounded individuals. And it's so beautiful being able to read their letters and read how they communicated with your family. You can hear their voices in your head. Some of them are really funny,
yes.
Some of them are like really tragic, but you feel as if you've got to know these people, even though in reality you've never met them, and you weren't even alive when they were alive in my case. But so that's why I wanted to ask you, was there anything particularly surprising that you found about Ralph and his biography? We've spoken a little bit about Australia, which is quite exciting as well, but anything else that particularly surprised you?
I think that the more I understand about him, the more I think that he was very far-seeing. I think he was somebody who was at the cutting edge of his generation, but very much of his own making. He did well at school, but he used that knowledge from a good school to do something completely out of the ordinary, and then had the courage of his convictions to go where the path took him. And so, almost like the advert in the paper that said wanted young men, for army experience in Australia, reminded me a little bit of Shackleton, and when he was recruiting for his famous expedition to the Antarctic, and it was five lines in the Times that said, wanted young men for dangerous expedition, you know, low pay, possibility of returning alive, doubtful sort of thing.
Yeah.
And kind of Ralph's life was a bit like that. Oh, I'm going to have a go at that then. Oh, I'll try teaching. Oh, great, I'll go back and do some more teaching. Oh, there's a war coming on. And he must have been through the recruiting office door pretty much, you know, as soon as war broke out and enlisting. And then he was on the first wave of students to go out on this new scheme to America to train through the Arnold scheme to be a pilot. And he must have done well out of that because he was creamed off to go straight to the Lancaster Bomber Fleet as a Pathfinder, which in early 1943 were still very much only a few months old, being created, and they were taking the best pilots from all the squadrons that existed and the best pilots from training, and to make this elite force. So again, he was up there at the innovative, elite, looking ahead type of approach. But then in the background, he was obviously a bit of a tinker as well, because a newspaper report said that he'd been pulled up and fined 5 shillings by the magistrate for riding his motorcycle without lights. So, you know, he was human as well, which is just lovely, isn't it? And he went home at weekends to visit his mum, and he stopped on the way to visit his auntie. You know, what a nice guy.
Yeah, he sounds really amazing. And it's so interesting to hear about these two sides of his personality, that on the one hand, he seems kind of wise beyond his years, and sort of
yeah.
able to reflect on things, but also is enjoying his youth as well. And I think if we've spoken quite a lot about his earlier life, but I'd like to concentrate a little bit more on sort of his own reflections on the war, if we know anything about them. So when you sent me your report, you discussed the night of the 12th of March 1943, in which Ralph's aircraft
yeah.
was shot down. And you describe how the aircraft, the Lancaster aircraft, was returning from a raid over Stuttgart when it was intercepted and shot down. Ralph was able to parachute to safety, but some of his crew members were unfortunately not able to, very soon after Ralph married Muriel. And I was just wondering, what influence do you think this incident had on Ralph, on his life?
I think, you know, he would have just been matter of fact about it.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting that he, because of his time in Australia, when he joined the RAF, he was a lot older than most of his contemporaries. And a lot of those pilots were 19, 20 years old and already sort of 50, 60 missions into their careers. And when Ralph was flying with his final squadron, he was 32, 33. So he had a lot of life experience behind him. And maybe that's why he was, you know, clearly respected and liked by the squadron. But that inner grit that we talked about that drove him to do things differently is probably what gave him the courage and fortitude to make his way with the resistance down the whole length of France, to walk across the Pyrenees, to get himself across Spain. And then the first thing he did once he'd been was safe all those months later, having half carried his mate who had got bad frostbite over the mountains, was straight back on a plane, straight back to the UK to rejoin the squadron and carry on with the job. And I think the ministry were quite good. They gave him some leave to get his health and his strength back. And so he used the time wisely to get married. But they really, I don't think, had known each other properly for very long, because the letters seem to indicate that whilst he was in America, they'd been friends whilst he was at college. We don't quite know how close. But the letter when he first wrote, when he got back, said, "Hi, remember me? You haven't heard from me for a year or so because I've been in America and, you know, I'm trying to get down to Oxford. Would it be nice if we met up for a drink?" type thing.
Yeah.
It must have been barely 6 months later, if that. Gosh, there they were married. And 3 months after that, he died. But that must, and that must have been so terribly typical of so many relationships at that time. I think they just went, let's not hang around, because who knows?
Yeah, and I think that there is such an appreciation of life there when you know that it's all so unpredictable, and it must have been such a horrible time to live in, but also a time where everyone was so grateful for everything, because the brevity was of everything was so uncertain, as you say. And you know, to lose your life 3 months after getting married, that's really hard for your partner that you leave behind as well.
And it's I never got a sense from, you know, we don't have many letters, and we're lucky to have any at all, but I never get a sense from reading the letters that there was any morbidity in his outlook on life. I get a sense that he was a naturally buoyant, optimistic person, because everything that they talk about, apart from being just the mundane details of, you know, who's picking up the gloves for the wedding and don't worry about a buttonhole type thing,
yeah,
and we'll sort the bands out, but everything is about looking forward. Everything's always about looking forward. Now, whether that was just a self-defense mechanism to not think too closely about the consequences, but I think it was just the generation. You just got on with it, didn't you? You didn't have any choice.
Yeah, and we've spoken about this sort of really vibrant personality that Ralph seemed to have that even comes through in these documents. And I was just wondering, do you have a favourite memory of Ralph, whether this be second or even third hand?
I suppose there's a couple. And again, this is just through picking up snippets and documents, really, where yeah, you suddenly come across something on a newspaper article. And he'd done an interview in America with a local paper in Atlanta, Georgia, and they were interviewing these, you know, these strange creatures that were the British airmen training on their airfield, and he'd been talking about how amazingly fast American cars were, with their, you know, enormous cars, and they all go so fast compared to the smaller cars that we had on the smaller roads in Britain. And I think if you add that to the thing, you know, he immediately wanted to fly, and getting fined by the policeman for not wearing lights on his motorbike, it's probably a bit of a petrol head on the quiet. which, when you look at some of the pictures, and this terribly smart, and almost sometimes almost get a little bit of a sense of quietly reserved, quite grown up individual who was a teacher. Underneath, you know, he was clearly quite a sparky character. But, you know, all this is supposition, isn't it? Because I never got a chance to talk to Muriel, even though she died comparatively recently, only in 2016. But she'd been quite poorly with Alzheimer's for a good number of years. And I think at the point where I understood the story enough and got to the point where I go, I must go and talk to Muriel, then she was beyond talking to.
Yeah.
Which is terribly sad for me now, and I suppose if I was ever going to put a message out to people, it's go and talk to your grandparents about what they did in the war before the story is lost, and make them write names down at the back of photographs, because it's... I suppose I've drifted away from the question here, but it just leads you to that piece. If you want to know about it, you've got to ask somebody who was there. Otherwise, you're trying to create your own mental image of them. I'd love to meet him, though. What a character.
Yeah, I would too. I think he sounds great. But yeah, no, I think that is a really important message, and I do think it's actually really relevant to the interview in terms of how important it is to appreciate the generation that are still around from this era, and also like encourage them, even if it's, you know, a bit of a pain to get them to write stuff down, or like you say, put dates on things. It really helps because we're only human, and memory is quite not always the most reliable. I know that I have to write things down all the time, so
Absolutely.
yes, that it's really important to have these written documents.
See, it's quite, what's interesting is my I talked to my father, who was he was only 5 when Ralph died, but he has some memory of him, and one of the memories that he has is that Ralph had come home at some point with a box full of bananas, and which was quite unusual in 1943. And the story was that he'd flown a mission where the plane had ended up in North Africa, refueled, and come home again. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, because around about 1943 to 44, they were doing bombing runs where they took off from the UK, did their bombing trip in Germany, but routed down to a safe airfield in North Africa, and then did the reverse trip, rather than going back the way they came. But as far as I can tell from all the squadron records, Ralph never did that.
Really?
And so in trying to establish the fact and the life of that memory, the story doesn't quite fit, and I can't work, and we'll probably never know. It seems likely that he had a friend or another crew or somebody had done a North Africa run and come back and pulled a bombay full of bananas and distributed them around their friends who took it home to the family. That's probably what happened. But again, without that actual memory evidence, you just don't know.
Yeah, that's such a great story about the bananas. I think that's also something really memorable and something that sticks with you is just these little snippets that seem so, like I say, they're almost unbelievable when you look back and you think that all of these things happened in such a short lifetime. I know that we've previously discussed that Ralph was actually quite a bit older considering his
Yes.
station in the military, but still, how much people can cram into those years is really impressive. And one of the things that you mentioned in your report is how Ralph was honoured with the Distinguished Flying Medal by the King for his
Yes.
conduct and also his evasion of capture. So I was just wondering, do you have any memories of how important this moment perhaps was in Ralph's career, or is it commemorated anywhere in the family?
There's again very little in the correspondence. It's a sort of a almost a one line in a letter about tennis and see you Saturday type things. Oh, and by the way, you might have seen in the paper that that I was given a gong or something. There was again just utterly matter of fact. But it was nice that by the time he got to his wedding, he'd got the ribbon sewn on for the medal. Even though which you can do, he hadn't actually been awarded the medal yet. So it had been in the London Gazette, so he could wear the ribbon, but he hadn't been to receive it. And actually, it wasn't until I think about 1947 when Muriel was invited to the palace to receive the medal posthumously on his behalf, which I think was a lovely thing to do. A lovely thing to do. I have no knowledge of how his parents took any of this. Like any parent, I imagine they were heartbroken, but interestingly, I don't think anybody from the family ever went out to Berlin to visit the cemetery. Even Muriel, who died as recently as only 7 or 8 years ago. And never remarried, and clearly held and treasured his memory absolutely dear. Yeah, I'll probably always wonder why did you not just go to Berlin and stand there, with some flowers? Yeah, don't know.
Yeah, I think that that points out that memory is such a personal thing and people grieve in so many different ways. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about Rav's passing and also sort of the immediate aftermath. So just for the listeners, on his 14th flight, a raid to Berlin on the 22nd of November 1943, Rav was shot down and lost his life. However, confirmation of his death was not possible until approximately a year later. So I was just wondering, what role did Muriel play in seeking to find more information about the fate of her husband? And how did Ralph's status as a missing person impact your family and perhaps even the local community?
Muriel, of course, received a telegram the following day. The standard, we get to inform you that Pilot Officer Henderson is missing following operations on the night of 22nd of November 1943. And that's all you get. And then it says letter to follow. And then a few days later, it's a letter from the squadron CO saying, you know, we're terribly sorry, he's missing. But there was quite a nice personal touch, which was, however, he's got a track record for evading. So we're all terribly optimistic because he was a very much loved member of the squadron. So we're always hopeful that he may have survived. And then there's a whole series of correspondence between Muriel and the Red Cross, trying to find out more information or seek confirmation. And eventually, lots of to and fro in the International Committee of the Red Cross, they confirmed that he was part of a crew that were identified having crashed in Berlin. And the whole crew, it seems, were interred together in a communal grave, or the whole crew in one grave together. So as that indicates, it must have been a fairly horrific crash. But the other thing she'd done, which I found incredibly touching, was that she'd sort of taken on the role of the captain's wife of the aircraft, and she had written personally to the families of all the other six crew members, I suppose expressing sympathy and hope and, come on, we'll all stick together and hope that this isn't as bad as it seems. And we know that she had done that because we've got three or four of the letters that had been written back in response, although we've never seen what she actually wrote. But again, it's tinged with that sense of maturity and duty that she went, oh, my husband was the skipper, the captain of the aircraft, and I'm his wife, so I'm going to do the captain's wife's thing and liaise with the relatives. And so she went on with that, and then I know that she kept close contact with the Pathfinders Association, and ultimately there was a tree planted at the National Arboretum. I think it's mentioned on a stained glass window, I think at Lincoln Cathedral. And then there was another memorial at Blythe in his hometown. I think there were two memorials in Blythe in his hometown, one in a local park. And also, I think there's a line in his parents' graves as well, I think. And so I suspect that quietly Muriel was behind ensuring that his memory was properly recorded and maintained. And yet, I mentioned in the story the red box file, all those neat and tidy little details of letters and the telegrams to and fro from the ministry, and other letters and pieces, she just quietly put it in a box and put it in the bureau and treasured it, but locked it away. Which is just fascinating, isn't it? It's really, really interesting, as you said before, about how people deal with those sorts of events. She kept the whole thing together as a package.
Yeah, and I think that it's really special, and it's something that I actually want to talk about, this special red box file in which there's all of these personal papers and memorabilia of their life together. So I was just wondering if we could talk a little bit about the role that personal documents play in the telling of history and how we can tell the stories of the fallen with greater humanity, because often you find that in history textbooks, or even in tours of the cemeteries, it's very easy to reduce these people to statistics when they have their own families, lives, memories that really should be heard.
It's I think as we've had a bit of a thread through the interview, it brings the story to life, because otherwise all you've got is a name on a cenotaph or a memorial somewhere. And I would hazard a guess that there are hundreds of thousands of people across the globe who have ancestors who fought brilliantly in conflicts on both sides, all sides, who either don't know they exist, or for they went, yeah, I think Grandad fought in the war, don't know what he did, might have been in the Navy, I think, and that's all they know. And the popular perception, of course, is that they're all just glittering heroes and heroines to be put on pedestals and go to Remembrance Days and wear your poppy. But underneath that, they're real people. They're just like you and me. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they have hopes and dreams and think about what they might do with their kids later on, and they worry about paying the mortgage and how they're going to get enough money for a car. And just, they were just ordinary people, but doing extraordinary things brought on by the circumstances of the time. And in the modern age, I think that call to duty, that narrative of doing your bit, is as relevant today as it was then. And the nearest comparison we've got in Britain, I suppose, is all the volunteers who turned out to give COVID vaccinations and run COVID centres and things. The national emergency, and that was what was needed. And suddenly, amidst all the doom that you hear about young people and social media, and suddenly there was everybody doing their bit, with a smile and a cup of tea and jabbing people in the arm and parking cars and all those sort of things. And so it's still in there, but without the documents and without the letters and without the narratives and the black and white films, and suddenly it's life, isn't it? And you can relate to it.
Yeah, and I think that as we're coming sort of towards our final question in the interview, it's really important, I think, to bring our sort of national narrative about the war into question, because as you say, it has its pros and cons. When you do hold the fallen on such a high pedestal, it's quite easy to forget they are human, as you say, because they become so mythologized that people are almost, it creates a greater distance between the generations sometimes, because it's really hard to visualize and really hard to understand if you haven't grown up in that generation, you haven't experienced the things that they've experienced. So I was just wondering, as our sort of final talking point of the interview, in what way Ralph's story has shaped your sense of identity?
I suppose it's done a number of things. I have learnt so much about our own modern history, which I think is something that as a nation we don't pay enough attention to, because we're just within living memory of some of these events, but not for very much longer. But the factors that shaped those wars, we see playing out again and again and again across the world today. And unless people understand that we've been here before and this is what we had to do about it, then it's very difficult to understand and appreciate what we might have to do about it again. And also for people to understand when you see your governments of any country taking particular actions with conflicts or wars or supply of weapons, the reasons why they're doing it. And that's just Bill's personal take on why modern history is so important. But for me, it helps me understand the generation of the armed forces that I've served in for nearly 40 years, and why we are the shapes the way we are, and why we have ships and regiments and weapons and as we do, because that's how they evolve for a particular reason. So that's one side, and the other side, I suppose, is gratitude to that generation. That the sacrifice and the duty that they really, really selflessly gave, even when it was difficult, dangerous, uncomfortable, lived with the lights out and rationing and all those kind of things, but people did it because they genuinely believed it was the right thing to do. And as they, you know, as they said, for their today, we have our tomorrow. Which is terribly important. So, the very least I think we can do as a generation is understand what our ancestors have done, be they personal relatives or generation, and keep that story alive for our children and grandchildren, because otherwise it's lost. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the sacrifice was meaningless, but it would mean so much more if people remembered and understood and perpetuated it. Because it might just be some way to stop it happening again.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point in terms of when we think about this generation, they're literally, you know, growing up, becoming adults in this world of darkness, you know, not, you know, figuratively and also literally in the blackouts. But you hear stories like Ralph, and they're so vibrant and they're so full of colour and they're so full of light as well. But I think that it's kind of infectious to tell these stories, and I think that it's really important to keep these candles burning, if you like, for this generation, because I do really think that it informs so much of where we are today, not just as a culture, as a country, but also as individuals. And I think that that generation really speaks to the tenacity of the human spirit as well. And I think that it really is, even though it's such a tragic time, and it's almost, you know, it's so hard to even comprehend, but there's still so much hope for what it means for the future and what these people achieved as well. So I think that's a really beautiful end to the interview. Thank you so much for sharing Ralph's story and giving us your time. It's been absolutely wonderful hearing these little personal snippets of Ralph's adventures.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to talk to you, Holly. And thank you for all you're doing with the project and helping to keep all these stories alive. And hopefully between this we'll inspire some people to go and talk to their relatives and dig through the box of old photos and ask the questions about what they were doing and maybe not send the medals off to auction or take them to the car boot sale, but frame them and hang them on the wall and be proud of them.
Yeah, I think that this, if there's a message, there's been so many beautiful moments throughout this interview, but I think if there's a message to any young people listening out here today, is go and pester your grandparents. Go and pester your grandparents to write things down. Go and ask the questions, because these stories are amazing. You know, they're the things that you really can't make up, but they also have shaped where you are today, and they are so intimately connected with who you are as a person. So please go out there and try and find these stories as we are doing today. So thank you.
Absolutely. No, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for your time too.
Ich bin Holly Perchel und das war die vierte Folge des Podcasts Unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen.